The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, everyone. Last week, I gave a talk on the Four Noble Truths, which centers around clinging, grasping, with the idea that on one side, if you cling, you'll suffer, and the other side, if you let go of that clinging, you'll be free of that suffering. Today I want to talk about one of the very primary forms of clinging that people have, and that's clinging to self. And some people will even argue that it's the most fundamental, most basic clinging. I don't think that Buddhism says it's the most basic, but it's among the most basic, and it often provides the cornerstone of a lot of other attachments. And if you pull out that cornerstone, the edifice of many attachments will crumble. There was a cartoon I saw many years ago, Calvin and Hobbes. Calvin's walking along, and he's underneath a magnificent night sky. It's awesome. And he's there in this beautiful, open, natural setting. And comes to one panel, and he, with great confidence, expressed in great confident body language, he kind of looks up into the sky and says, I am significant. And then he walks along, and then at the last panel, his body language is that of kind of, I don't know, despair or collapse or kind of being really small, hunched over. And he whispers, said the dust mote. So one is self-assertion and the other is self-deprecation. And some people's lives oscillate between those two. The issue of self here today is not so much the philosophical issue of is there a self or not a self, but it has to do with the issue of clinging to our ideas of self, what is self. And one of the places where in my life where that really got highlighted for me was when I was living at a Zen monastery in Japan. And my Japanese was pretty basic at that point. I was still learning Japanese. And so when I spoke Japanese, I tended to speak Japanese as you would speak English, rather than how you would speak if you were Japanese. And one of the things that became clear to me when I was there was in English, we use a lot of pronouns. We use a lot of pronouns. The Japanese tend to be pronoun shy, or they don't use a lot of pronouns that often. And the pronoun of the sentence, the person, the subject of the sentence, is understood in context. So if you're walking out the door and you say, in English you say, I'm leaving. In Japanese you'd just say, leaving. And you know, you're the one who's leaving, so you don't need to add the I, just that's clear enough. And so there is a way in Japanese of saying I. So if it's needed, if the context is not enough, of course you can add it in. But it's kind of not used that often. And when it is used, the word for I is three syllables long. And you have to use, usually when you use those three syllables, you have to add at the end of it I don't know what the grammatical term is, but this word that connects that I to the rest of the sentence, which is the word wa. So you have to end up saying four syllables. And in English, when it's translated to English, with the Japanese use of watashi wa, it's usually translated as something like, as for me. So it's a little cumbersome, you know, you go around and say, as for me, I'm leaving. As for me, leaving. So here I was in Japan, this monastery, trying to speak Japanese, and I noticed after a while that most of my sentences began with watashi wa. and it stood out like a sore thumb. And I just couldn't, you know, it was very hard for me to stop talking that way, because I was such a strong habit in English to refer to I think this, I think that, you know. And so it stood out for me how much of my language was self-referential. And that became an interesting area of study. What's going on here with me? why so? And why was it needed? And when I tried to not be self-referential, I felt kind of a little disoriented. I mean, you know, if I stopped, I didn't use the pronoun. Where am I in this? It was a little awkward. So I found it a very interesting area of study in myself. And then we come to meditation, of course, but at least for some of us. It's interesting to notice how much of one's thinking is self-referential as well. And in fact, I think many people find that if they tallied what they're thinking about, one way or the other, what they think about is mostly self-referential in nature. It's about me or my relationship to others or what happened to me or what, you know, what I want. Or some wonderful fantasy where we're an actor in the fantasy. So there's nothing inherently wrong with starting sentences with I, nothing inherently wrong with having thoughts which are you're the main subject of the drama. But it is certainly worth looking at, and looking at what motivates that, what prompts that, and what goes on with this self-concern, with this self-assertion, whatever. And in this regard, Buddhism has this very interesting teaching about conceit, that there are three kinds of conceit in Buddhism. The usual kind of conceit, that I'm special, I'm better than someone else. And then there's a conceit that I'm worse than someone else. And sometimes in Buddhist circles, it's pointed out that people who are very, very shy have a lot of self, a lot of self-identity. And that goes kind of a little bit against the usual idea of someone who's shy, who maybe doesn't say, or that person doesn't have much self. It's kind of like, you know, shy. It's kind of like withdrawn. But to have that energy and that activity of being withdrawn or shy or hesitant sometimes comes along with a very strong sense of I that we're trying to protect, that we don't want to be threatened or something. So one form of conceit then is to consider oneself less than others. And a third kind of conceit is that we're equal to others, and which is a, you know, a great American ideal. We're all equal. And now we're told that it's a conceit. So what's left? And what's left is actually very significant. And what's left is don't play the comparison game. So don't compare yourself to others. And just kind of live your life without that comparison. So if you need to walk down the road, or like Calvin, walk across the mountaintop with a great sky, to neither assert I'm significant or desert that I'm insignificant, but rather simply walk. In Zen they say, when you walk, you walk. You know, you don't have to compare your walking to others. Am I walking well? Am I walking poorly? And all that kind of stuff. Tongue-in-cheek definition of self is that self is wind drag. You put out your hand in the car and you create wind drag. You assert the self, drags you down. Drag slows you up. So there's many ways in which people assert self, and one of them is to be somebody. People want to be somebody. In fact, we're supposed to be somebody. We're supposed to grow up and become something. In a sense, in many ways, it's quite expected and appropriate to grow up and somehow have roles and work and activities we do. But there's also a lot of clinging to being somebody. So the example maybe I've given before is that of when I was in seventh grade, an art teacher told me I had no artistic talent. And it never occurred to me that I even should have artistic talent. I didn't care if I had artistic talent or not, but here this authority figure had told me I had none, so it must be the case. And so I didn't bother me, one bit. But I took it on as part of my identity. Oh, I'm that kind of person. Thanks to the seventh grade teacher. Until I was kind of tricked into doing art by my born-again artist roommate in college. And I started doing a lot of art, so much so that I took art classes and became an art major. Mostly I became an art major so I can get into the art classes that required you to be in the major. It wasn't like I was planning to be. It was kind of a little deceitful, I suppose. I was just wanting to take those classes, so I became an art major for a while. But then it became this magic day where I decided that I was now an artist. And it's kind of an amazing story. It's hard to believe, perhaps, but this is how it worked. Is the day that I decided I was going to be an artist was the day I stopped doing art. Because somehow in my mind, then I had to be a certain way. I had to do it for the sake of identity, and I couldn't do it for that reason. And so I kind of stopped that day. And many years later, when I became was living in Buddhist monasteries, and the creativity was kind of just flowing out of the context of the practice, I started doing some again. But this idea of the identity, someone gave me an identity, which limited me. And then at some point I assumed an identity, and that also limited me. So what's it like to do art, for example, without an identity? In my particular situation, it worked a lot better. It's a lot much more enjoyable to do art without being the artist. There's no need to be the artist. If there's a need or if there's a delight or a love, it's doing the art. The issue of, am I a better artist than someone else? Am I a worse artist than someone else? It should hopefully be a distant second, distant third, fourth from just the expression, the delight, the joy, the what comes out for its own sake. So how much of life is lived in comparison? And then it's wind drag, it limits us. And how much of it is just lived for itself? Without needing to compare. A huge amount of human suffering arises out of comparative thinking. And a lot of the suffering around being a self, being someone, also arises out of that movements of comparison. And so to somehow find a way to be present without comparison is very significant. So there's being somebody, and you can probably consider in your own life ways in which you try to be somebody, or ways that someone else try to assign somebody to you, and how that was so limiting. You're someone's spouse, or you're a particular role, and you want to just kind of hit them over the head and say, I'm more than that. Please don't limit me in that kind of way. Then there's also the movement of being nobody. And this is a trap for people sometimes doing Buddhist practice. Of course, we're not supposed to be somebody. We're supposed to be nobody, so I'm going to be the best nobody around. And so, that just becomes another way of being somebody, the somebody who's nobody. And the dangerous way of doing that is to then start denying parts of who we are. Letting go of parts of who we are shouldn't be let go of. So sometimes we let go, some people let go of their feelings. Well, if I'm nobody, if I'm just empty and radiant, then I'm never supposed to be angry. So we let go and we kind of basically deny it. But trying to be nobody, walking around like, oh, I don't have any feelings. And I haven't heard about this for decades, but there was a time in the 70s where there were usually young idealistic men. He would come back from Asia doing Buddhist practice, and they would, you'd ask them how they were, and they would say, oh, there's a lot of energy coursing through this system here. Yeah, but how are you? oh, the energy is moving up and left and right, you know. But you, and you know, you couldn't get them to say anything about who they were, you know, just how they were feeling. And it just seemed odd. It seemed like it was kind of like a kind of conceit, you know, I'm not that kind of person. And it wasn't quite human. And they were, you know, they could easily have said, I'm fine, thank you. And so there's kind of, you know, denying sometimes feelings or denying certain kind of movements within us. Something people, a popular form back then, people who had this kind of being nobody ideal, was to not deny their sexuality. And it's sometimes pointed out that people who deny their sexuality take up, as a substitute, take up anger. And so that's another one. So then also, or money. You deny money or deny any kind of self-assertion. I know someone who, it's a bit irritating to go to restaurants with, because what restaurant would you like to go to? Well, I don't care. Whatever you want to do. You know, maybe that person thinks it's very generous, like you choose. And then, but then you come to the restaurant, and what would you, you know, you time to order? Oh, what are you having? You know, well, you know, you'd order for me. And no ability to, you know, no willingness to make a choice. Such simple things are, you know, and it's one thing to say, I don't care where we go. It's another thing to say, well, I think I'd like Thai food, but whatever you want is fine as well. So to offer something, a wish or something, to add to the conversation. So kind of deny that I have needs, to deny I have wishes, and kind of just be there and kind of in a just empty kind of way, can be very inappropriate as well. We're attached to it. So to be someone is a problem. To be nobody's a problem. And what's the alternative? And for some people, the idea of an alternative seems pretty bleak. And so, you know, not only bleak, but maybe frightening. I find that in myself, when I look at I, like I'm doing now, I assertions, and why am I saying I? You know, talking about myself again. And look at that and start questioning it, studying it, I have a variety of emotional responses to it, depending on the circumstance. Sometimes I'm just tickled by it. There it is again. And it's kind of like, I can't seem to do without it. And it's just kind of like an odd thing. And it's, here it is again, I'm just tickled. Sometimes I'm humored by it. Sometimes I'm irritated by it. Sometimes I'm a little bit anxious by this whole looking at it and questioning it and wondering about it. Sometimes I feel a little bit guilty about it, because it feels like, oh, here I am again, asserting myself. So there's a whole variety of spectrum of kind of things that can arise. Buddha's practice offers an alternative to being somebody and being nobody. Just like the alternative to being a good artist or being a bad artist, or being an artist and not being an artist, is just doing the artwork, just doing that activity. And the alternative that Buddhism gives, or at least one of the important alternatives, to it, is feeling really good and happy without it being, without being tied to the notion of a self. Being tied to ideas or clinging or concepts of this is who I am, this is who I'm not. To be free of that kind of comparative thinking, that kind of conceptualization. And one of the ways to discover this is through meditation practice. In meditation practice, as the mind gets calmer, the activity of selfing also calms down. So the idea of needing to be somebody and assert oneself is an activity of the mind. Calvin is doing something when he says, I am significant. Calvin's also doing something when he says, collapsing on the ground, I am the, you know, says the dust mote. Both of them are activities of the mind. The mind is thinking certain things. When that activity calms down and we sit in meditation and allow a wellspring of well-being to come, then there's a sense of well-being that's free of self-assertion or self-deprecation. A sense of well-being that kind of is there independent of needing to be somebody. How many of our feelings arise because of our sense of self, our ideas of self? And how many feelings and emotions arise independent of needing to be somebody? It's been pointed out that often enough, boredom, especially in social situations, has a lot to do with how we think of ourselves, how we hold ourselves. When people are praising us, praising myself, there's a lot of good energy there. When people are criticizing us, there's a lot of energy there in response. When someone is neither praising or criticizing us, when someone doesn't have some kind of role and kind of our self-identity, the sad thing is that sometimes certain people get, there's boredom arises. What about guilt? Guilt often a time arises when the self, our self-definition, our self-ideas, is guilt, is feeling bad, it's wrong. And I was an expert at guilt. Gil is short for guilt. And so I really saw this very clearly when I was a new Zen student. And I would open, I felt guilty about the way I opened the door to the meditation hall. I feel guilty about the way I walked across the meditation hall floor. You know, it's, you know, is that something to feel guilty about? But I was so good at it. But there was so much self involved, so much concern about how the people saw me and who I was and what was the right way and the wrong way and all this stuff. I was just kind of completely caught up in this selfing world. And so that came then with, you know, for me, it came with guilt. Fear. How much of fear as well arises in the context or in relationship to ideas of self, self-assertion, self-deprecation, how people, what people are going to think about myself, who I am. I think that much fear, social fear, has to do with our idea of self, our selfing that we're doing. And probably we can go through the list of a variety of different emotions and find. An interesting one is joy or delight or happiness. How much joy and happiness arises because of the idea of self, the selfing idea, is being successful, is being praised or having good things happening to it. And what's wrong with that? Is there anything wrong with that? I have a good macho identity, thank you. And I win the California Grand Prize in a Maserati. I feel great in my macho self, thank you. Is there anything wrong with that, having that kind of joy? I think what's when clinging to self is reinforced by being successful, it reinforces, it strengthens it. And it's a setup for problems. It's a setup for it to be disappointed or discouraged or the rug gets pulled out from under it. So we have to be very careful, even with the joy and the delight that comes in our life, when that joy and delight comes from this kind of clinging to self. There's a whole other series of emotions that can arise, or maybe some of the same ones that can arise, that don't arise based on self, selfing. And some of the greatest forms of happiness and peace, joy and love that are available to people are available when they're not playing the selfing game. In fact, the selfing game is a limits the full blooming of some of the most beautiful qualities a human being can experience. So meditation can be, not always or not necessarily quickly, can be one of the places to discover a sense of well-being that doesn't involve the selfing game. And as I started saying earlier, it's because we quiet down the selfing activity. And it takes a while. It's not so easy. It's almost like we have an addiction to selfing. And it keeps wanting to assert itself or do this and that or defend itself or do something. And to have enough trust in just being alive, just trust, just being, to be able to let go of the selfing movements, the selfing attempts. Takes a while, but eventually the trust is there, the letting go is there. And then maybe go beyond, kind of step, go past the maybe the fear or the anxiety about not having a self, and then find a sense of well-being that wells up, that comes from a deeper place, more core place inside of us than the place that selfing comes from. In a sense, selfing, I think, is more of a surface phenomenon. And in relationship, in comparison at least, to this deeper wellspring of peace and well-being. And I use the word wellspring out of choice because the Buddha talked about joy and happiness arising from within like a refreshing spring flowing into a lake. So you have a very still, beautiful lake, and deep below is a natural spring, and this water flows up and kind of flows out and spreads across the lake with this refreshing water. So one of the reasons why meditation can be so radical is that that well-being that can happen there becomes a contrast to the well-being or the lack of well-being that's there from playing the selfing game. And one of the things that you're encouraged to do as meditators is if you start feeling some modicum of well-being or calm or peace, is to start appreciating how that exists in relationship to selfing, in relationship to being self-assertive or self-deprecating or having self-concern. Because you can see, you can watch, it's kind of like when you have some deeper calm or peace, it can highlight how much we're selfing, and it can show us an alternative. So it might be easier to notice it when it happens and be tickled by it or humored by it or aghast, and also then see that there's an alternative to it. As we begin finding and living more and more in the alternative to selfing, it also gives us a certain kind of power that comes when we haven't given our power to others. Because a lot of the selfing game has to do with how we want to be seen by others and recognized by others. And as when we give a lot of power to other people that way, and not being concerned with that anymore, the power comes back here to us. And in fact, in the early Buddhist texts, they occasionally will call an enlightened person a great self, having a great self. You know, like Mahatma Gandhi, the Mahatma of his name is a title. It means the great self, the Maha-Atma, Atman. And even back in the time of the Buddha, they used that phrase in Pali, Mahatta. The great self. So the absence of self doesn't mean that you can, you know, there comes this power as well. And that power doesn't mean that we don't care anymore about what other people think of us. And that's part of the danger of all this kind of approach. Oh, now I'm not supposed to have a self. I can just be an artist. Come what may. I'm not going to be an artist. I'm not going to be an artist. I'm not going to be an artist. I'm just going to barrel ahead and do art. I'm just going to go home now, and I'm just going to paint and draw and sculpt. And who's going to diaper the kid and make the dinner and pay the taxes? And, you know, what I'm going to try to say here is that we don't want to let go of consideration about how other people see us and how other people relate to us. It's important feedback. It's important information. It's important to notice how other people are. But it's possible to do it without it relating back to our sense of self and our clinging to self. Someone might think that you're a terrible person. It's good to know that. But you don't have to buy that or take it in or be troubled by it, but it's good to know it. And then you can go talk to them and say, what gives? What's going on here? We'd like to talk about this. Or someone thinks you're a great person. Wow, you're the best. Well, you don't have to question that. No, you should question. You should, you know, again, you don't take that on as well. You just don't take that on as a coat to wear. You say, oh, that's interesting. It's good to know that person sees me that way. Maybe I'll be more cautious now. Or maybe, you know, it's, we'll celebrate together a little bit. But I'm not going to pick it up and buy into it. I'll just kind of appreciate that that's what's going on. So to be free of self doesn't mean that we don't live in a social world where we understand how we fit into the social world. But it means that our core happiness and well-being is not tied to that social sense of self. And if it's not tied to that social sense of self, I think there's a greater power to be had. And this becomes very important, especially when so many people, so many people's experience in social life is that people are trying to take our power away from us. You know, people do terrible things to each other in the way that they self for us. They put us in selves, prejudice and things. So I think it's a very radical and profound, maybe even revolutionary thing to do, to discover a wellspring of happiness and peace that's not dependent on some notion and idea of self. So we have about 10 minutes. This is a good time for some of you to either assert yourself or something with your questions, comments, testimonials, or protests about this. So please.
Hi, I'm Carla. Ooh, my name is Carla.
People call me Carla.
I think I get some of this. This idea of I'm not better than, I'm not worse than, I'm not equal to, non-comparison. I'm very moved. I get stuck on one idea. I've spent a lot of time learning to give I messages. You know, in relationships, instead of saying, you're just all wrong, or you make me so mad,
right?
Or you never listen, to instead say, I feel ignored, I feel upset, that kind of thing.
Great. I think in our current culture, maybe this will change when we have, but in our current culture, it seems to work really well to make I statements. Because people are less defensive, it's less attacking. Just what this experience here is, without some statement or interpretation of what's out there. And I advise people to learn that skill of making I statements. But it's possible to do that, to use the word I, without being fooled by it. Without kind of assuming that there's some kind of reified sense of self here. This is who I really am. So, oh, when you said X, I felt hurt. You don't have to say, oh, I'm a hurt person. That's who I really am. I'm going to walk around being this identity of being hurt. You better see me as being hurt. And I'm going to prove to you that I'm hurt. It's just, oh, I felt hurt. And leave it really simple and light. Treat it as software as opposed to hardware. You know, so I think it's actually wise. So we have to learn how to use the word I and not be fooled by it. And you see in the teachings, in the discourses of the Buddha, he was quite freely at times used the word I and referred to it that way. But, we're not fooled by it.
So, Tail, ending your last statement, it would be using the word I without ID.
Thank you. Yes, here now.
I'm trying to think of how to phrase this. So, I understand it seems a little black and white, what you're saying, self and not self. I think the self is very complicated. It has a lot of components that maybe the Buddha didn't talk about or know about. And I do think it's important to understand all these components of the self without becoming attached to them. But to speak of it as if it's this one thing is a little confusing to me.
So I think it's very wise what you're saying. I think it's very complex, the whole phenomena of self, the ideas, associations, the social context of self. I think it's a very rich topic to explore and get to know better. I think it's important to see there's a very subtle cultural conditioning, cultural ideas that are come into how different people understand what it means to be a self. And it's very interesting to go study in different cultures and see have different senses of self that are almost not even conscious of. For example, also when I was at the same monastery in Japan, I woke up one day, kind of, and every day we did this very intense cleaning of the temple. There were about 20 of these young Japanese men and me. We do this very intense soji, cleaning period, together. And one day in the middle of doing this, after doing it for a few months with them, I kind of woke up and realized that they were living in a different social universe than I was living in. And I was living in a universe of independent selves, autonomous, independent selves, individuals, who somehow bumped into each other and worked kind of around each other, with each other and all that. But the unit was the self. For them, the unit was the group. And they were elements of the group, of this one big whole. And it was like, oh, it's a different social universe. I had no idea. I'd been living with these people for months, and I had no idea they were living in a different universe than I was living in. I didn't feel like one was bad and one was good. It was just different cultural ways. So I think there's a lot to understand about all this, and I think it's well worth spending time studying the ideas of self. Of our cultural, our personal, and all the different elements. And maybe you would like to list some of the things, the complexity. And at the same time, to do that study and that work is a lot easier if you know, have a sense of being, a presence of peace, of well-being, that's not dependent on all this self. But now I'm very interested for you to give me a list of some of the complex elements.
I don't want to give you a list of my complex elements. But I remember one time you said, when Gil speaks Italian, it's a different Gil. When Gil speaks Norwegian. But what I notice is there are times, it's as if there's certain things glom around. There's a bunch of selves, yeah. and you can respond from a very different. I don't know why, and I don't know if it's true of everybody, but I think that there's not one self you're working with.
Right.
Maybe, at least I'm not.
Yeah, but I think as that's what Buddhism would say is that there is there's nothing, no one thing, nothing. And no
consolidated things
which qualify as the self, enduring, permanent, lasting kind of self. That if at the best, what is considered self is a constantly shifting and morphing phenomena that changes and morphs based on the situation we're in. And so who I am changes, and I'm very aware of that my sense of self, the way I am as a person, changes and morphs, sometimes subtly, sometimes in a big way. And so to mention one, for example, that maybe would interest you here. So I've been teaching this group here since 1990. And so I started teaching this group here when I just started becoming a teacher. And so I watched how my sense of self, or my sense of myself as a teacher, got shaped by this mutual interaction between the group and me. And you could watch the shaping and forming of that. And it was kind of fascinating to watch that, and my sense of self and a variety of things changed and shifted. And I could see it happen in that kind of in the relationships and mix and the feedback and all the stuff that goes on. So Gil as a teacher was a mutually created phenomenon. You know, it's not like, oh, that's, I'm really a teacher. That's who I essentially, permanently, truly am, and I made it. I'm a self-made teacher. I've done it. You know, it's just this thing that happened. You know, and I just kind of hold it lightly, and it's a thing that happened, and it'll change and shift, and someday you guys will all just, you know, turn your back on me, and I'll sit up here by myself and try to hold forth, and no one will be here. And I said, oh, I guess that particular one is over. And then I'll go do something else. there's a painting that I want to do that I'm just kind of, when am I going to find time for that painting? So this could be the last one.
I'm not sure whether I should be introducing myself because I saw Martha giving me a look. Like I should. I'm new here. But I had a quick question, so hopefully some of you can relate to it too. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to ask, so hopefully you will understand. So what I've realized is that, you know, it's, I guess, having a balance between meditating and then having your daily, weekly, or yearly goals. So what I realized is the more I get into meditation, the less kind of important the conventional goals, etc., are becoming. But at the same time, I also feel that when you're not pursuing such goals, etc., there is a sense of discomfort. So I'd just like to hear your views on that.
That's a great question. Great question, and I think it deserves a long answer, but I'll give you a relatively short one. I think that maybe at the heart of the question is not so much what the goals are, but rather what motivates our pursuit of the goals. So there are a lot of worthwhile things to do in life. There's also a lot of things which are not particularly worthwhile that people do pursue. And not few, I met a lot of people who have given up careers because they realized this wasn't really worthwhile to do, that particular goal. But there are also goals that are very worthwhile to do. what motivates it is a strong attachment to self, to proving oneself, being the best in your field so you can stand on top of everybody else and stick your tongue at them. That's not a very good, that's the one kind of motivation, and that might fall away. But someone might pursue the same career, same goal, out of compassion, because this is a way to help a lot of people. Or this is the way to feed my family. And I really need to take care of my family and raise my family properly. And so I really need to have this kind of worldly success enough to do that in a way that has some security to it. So I'm going to pursue the goal for that purpose. So to look at the motivation, look at to see what motivates it, what are we trying to accomplish? And what I believe, is that there are very, very powerful motivations, healthy motivations in a human being that can, for certain individuals, set very, very powerful goals and directions for their life. It's not meant for everyone. There's so many different ways of being in this life. You don't have to have goal. But some people find that... Is that a satisfying enough question, or do you want to ask further?
Yeah, maybe if you don't have time, I can have a chat with you later. So I guess the question was more with, you know, how do you find the balance, kind of, because I do find a lot of joy while meditating and doing all those stuff, but at the same time I also find it satisfying to be involved in certain activities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yeah, so I don't know, again, I don't know you, but I think that... some people find that that setting priority is really important. some people you can't do it all. And so it depends what's most important. And so one of the things I encourage people to reflect on is spend some time reflecting on it. In fact, sometimes I say this is actually more important to do than to meditate. If you had to choose between meditation and this, choose this. That is, spend some quiet time and reflect what your deepest intention is. And if meditation then supports that deepest intention, then meditate. If it doesn't, chuck the meditation. What's your deepest intention? And that might help clarify, you know, how you find your way among many, many healthy and good things to do in life. Can't do it all. And we can't do it all well. So you usually have to choose somehow. Okay. Many thanks.